Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
And I'm Chris Bernard.
Dwayne DeFreitas will be joining us a little later. He's running a little late. This week, Facebook Home on an iPhone? Well, kinda. Mark Zuckerberg pushes for immigration reform. Twitter Music. Dish goes after Sprint. Google Glass. Google Fiber. And Google Star Trek? So, Chris, it's been a while since we've talked to you. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I apologize for the long absence. I had a move, and I keep thinking that work is going to get sane at some point, but I think the nature of doing a startup is that it never really stops being insane. So it's good. We're doing really well. We're approaching some good milestones at work, and sort of starting to really polish it out, and still enjoying, you know, working with the team and everything. So
I'm just glad
to be back.
I'm glad that you're back too. I'm happy to personally know someone who has a startup.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. It's just never the way that I imagine it. You know, like you sort of imagine that you'll feel official and like I know things, and it's like I don't know everything. But you learn a lot, and it's fun, and it's really rewarding. I think that's like really the primary reason to do it. Like, you know, everyone knows that we're all, you know, taking a risk, and we're all trying to do something that's never been done before, and that's, you know, inherently risky, but it's far more rewarding than, at least for me, than, you know, a lot of other jobs I've had.
And just for the listeners, just remind everybody what your startup is and what it does.
Oh, yeah. So this company is called GroupTie. It came really very much out of some of the software that I wrote when I was at Startup Digest. We built some sort of internal tools for managing our community. Startup Digest is a very like distributed community. So GroupTie is essentially a web application that helps large groups communicate and work effectively. So it allows large groups that have sort of differing structures, so like there might be committees or you know, different types of members, to communicate effectively with each other, for the administrators of the group to communicate effectively, for the sort of like institutional knowledge of a group to take on an identity of its own. That's really sort of what we're trying to be, is a place that helps you create institutional knowledge, but also helps that institutional knowledge not leave the institution and not sort of like fall away. So a lot of our customers are professional groups or alumni groups. We have like investor groups in there, you know, anything where there's a large number of people who are sort of connected under some identity and have some reason to be together, but are not necessarily in the same room every day or doing the same thing every day. Although it could easily be used as an internal company directory too. That's how we're using it, as our internal. Like, we basically don't use email at work. We use GroupTie to communicate because it ensures that every conversation that we have, you know, even if I'm not part of an email thread about, you know, fundraising or the business thing, I can still go on and know what's going on in the group. And even if somebody leaves the group, then that information is still there. Whereas, you know, with email, you know, you might have a really great email thread between four or five people, but then it just disappears and no one can find it again, especially once those people move on or change their computers or whatever. So it's pretty exciting. I'm really enjoying it. It's really cool to sort of, as we start getting more people, to be doing support calls and realize like, hey, like people really are using this and they get really annoyed when it doesn't work. And there's a actually building something that people like.
That's where you want to be. That's exactly where you want to be, where people are using your service and your, you know, and they're relying on it. They're making it part of their workflow.
Yeah, exactly. So pretty stoked about it. It's been about 6 months that we've been doing it, so That's exactly 6 months. So we were part of a group called First Floor Labs, which is an accelerator program sort of run through AOL, although independent from them. We started back in October, and the first class, 6 months of the program, and that's over. So it's kind of a big milestone to have made it that far.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the headlines here this week. So you can't get Facebook Home on your iPhone, but you'll be able to get most of the buzzed about features from Facebook's new mobile software, because Chatheads, one of the Facebook Home services, has come to iOS devices via a Facebook app update. Chatheads are the clever update on the notification system most smartphone users are already familiar with. Instead of getting a text update when a pal wants to talk to you, you'll see a circular picture of your pal's head. I don't know if you have an Android phone and have been using...
My friends are not cool enough to text me on Facebook. So I've been trying to figure out exactly how this is going to work. But it looks to me like you sort of like get a little pop-up notification with the picture of their head saying that they want to talk. And then it's sort of like... It just sort of overlays on your Facebook, like, wall?
Mm-hmm. I have not used it. I just updated Facebook myself, and I have not used it yet. And I am texting you right now.
Oh. So we will test this live on there. Yeah, I literally just got this today. So I was really confused. It'd be like, Facebook heads. I'm like... You mean like their profile picture? That's not a new feature. Like, that's been around a while.
I'm seeing your head on the upper right hand part of my screen.
Now I can drag it around too.
No, okay. Cool. So now I've moved into the main sort of Facebook window, and I still see your little circular head in the right hand sidebar of my window.
I see what they're doing. So it's essentially a way of bringing interactivity into the feed so that you can get these notifications. So now if I click on it.
Yeah.
Oh, I see it. So this would actually be really good if you have multiple conversations happening at once. So I understand it actually probably is a much better for something like Home, where it can basically always be part of your screen. Hi. But.
Oh. All right.
So now what happens when you send me another one? I see it.
Send
it's kind of a cool effect. I like the feeling of being able to drag it around. That's actually kind of fun. Like, it almost feels like a window, which actually feels kind of odd on an iOS device, because there's just nothing like a window anywhere on any.
Oh, yeah, you can drag it around. Yeah, you can drag it anywhere on the screen.
Well, you have to be careful, because I've accidentally dragged it off the bottom of the screen.
You're right.
Times.
I just did that, too.
I just did that. Yeah, exactly. So it got to be a little bit careful.
So, but just also, FYI, you drag it to the bottom and you undo the chat heads effect.
Yeah, and now, of course, you still have your favorites on the left-hand side. Honestly, a lot of people use Facebook chat. I mean, it seems like it's really taken over what AIM and MSN really had for a lot of people. I don't know if that really matches, like, the demographics of this particular audience, but like amongst my brother and his friends and my sister and her friends, I mean, Facebook chat is like the standard way that they communicate.
It's so weird because, you know, when I was like, I grew up as the web was evolving. So, but for me, the first sort of intercommunication experience that I had with people on a regular basis was email. So in a way, like, I'm just barely graduating out of using email and onto using Twitter as like a regular form of communication. And meanwhile, generations after me they don't even know email. Like, they started on Twitter and Facebook, and Facebook is now a regular thing for them.
You know, one thing that I think is difficult that is kind of like funny for me, like seeing this happen. We're seeing a lot of the same problems over again with the similar problems that happened with email. Like one of the early problems with email compared to traditional mail before it is that you would get an email and it would like not have, you know, it'd be important, but then you'd never be able to find it again.
Right.
And like, you know, one of the really awesome things that, you know, Google did with Gmail is they made email not just a communications platform, but a record of that communications, which is kind of important because like email was really the first like human endpoint of the web, mm-hmm. right? So like a domain name, like, you know, google.com is a organizational endpoint of the web. It's or a server endpoint or a computer endpoint. It's something that you're guaranteed to get that organization or that group when you go there. Whereas an email is something that when you go there, in a sense, like you're guaranteed to get that person, you know? Like even if you go to chrisbernard.com, you don't get me. You get stuff I've posted, but there's no way of contacting me as me. And email, you know, was the first place to get that. And so like making a way that you could archive the communication and save it was really valuable. But now, you know, Facebook chat and Twitter and all the other ones have the problem of like, there's lots of conversation and I could not tell you what I tweeted 6 months ago
right.
or who I talked to or any of that stuff. Same thing with Facebook. Like it just sort of disappears off yeah. the bottom of the fold you and you're really never going to see it again.
Like you can't. Currently, you can't search Twitter or Facebook for a thread of your comments. Like,
yeah.
You can't.
You know that theoretically it's there somewhere, yeah. but.
Like you could find it, in theory, you could find it through Google if you need to, but you couldn't necessarily find it on Twitter or Facebook itself.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of interesting, like. Yeah, I don't know. I don't understand exactly why they haven't, you know, done more around those. I mean, I presumably Facebook has that information. Presumably Twitter has that information. Mm-hmm. Just, I guess it's not that valuable for them to make that shareable, or maybe that's so much of what drives their, you know, advertising stuff.
I guess, you know what, I bet you that kind of thing will become more important if necessity dictates it through, increased push in marketing like Twitter is attempting to do.
Yeah. Does anyone know how effective Twitter is right now? I mean, like, there's a lot of talk about Facebook and Facebook's monetization through ads and everything, but I mean, Twitter is clearly pushing pretty heavily on that. I'm just curious if anyone has any sense of if it's being successful or not.
I have no idea. Like, I have no idea, or I don't really know anyone who has experienced it on that end of benefiting from it. Mm-hmm. I guess we would have to know somebody at Twitter. Personally,
yeah. I mean, I must admit for myself, like I end up clicking on Twitter ads far more than probably any other type of ad out there. I don't know why. I can't tell you. Like, I just, you know, I'll just be tweeting along, and sometimes it's just that I don't notice that it's different. I'm just like, oh, that looks like an interesting link. Or sometimes it, like, one thing that effective Twitter ads can do is they can really sort of get your interest peaked. Like, just ask a little question with a link, and you're just like, I don't know what the answer to that question is, you know? And even if it's a company that I just have no interest in or, like, no, like, whatever, like, I'll still click on it and find out about it, you know? I don't know. I don't know if that's effective. Maybe that's the opposite of what effective advertising is, but it's interesting sort of seeing them as they sort of try to monetize and just curious, wondering how well they're doing at it.
I'm curious about, like, I can't wait to see how that.
Yeah. By the way, I wasn't around for Facebook Home, but I think Facebook Home is brilliant. I mean, in a I would probably never use it sort of way, but so much more so than the Facebook phone that people have been talking about forever.
Yes.
Like, I thought the Facebook phone was just like the stupidest idea in the world. Like, it just, an idea that is going to be extremely expensive and extremely embarrassing. It's going to be, it would have been the Facebook version of Kin.
It's a business they don't need to be in. Like, this is how they need to
implement
this.
There's no reason
this.
For them to be in. It's just simply asking for trouble. This is genius. I mean, they're taking Google's whole, like, platform and they're turning it. They're essentially hacking Android. Like, next thing they're going to have, like, the Facebook keyboard, you know, so that even if you're, like, in a different, like, app, you can still, like, have the little heads pop up, you know, as soon as you have your keyboard up. And then, of course, they'll probably, like, log everything that you type, you know, to Facebook servers. But, I mean, in an evil way, it's just brilliant. I got to hand it to them. So,
they've pivoted from being, you know, pivoted very well from being close to, just before, I remember, you know, a year or so before they went public, there was serious doubts that Facebook was going to be able to continue. I mean, we knew that they would continue in some form or fashion, but not anywhere near as successful as they are now. Because it's still unclear exactly how Facebook is managing to monetize themselves, you know, like how they're going to monetize themselves
at the scale that they need to, given that the valuation they have. I mean, that's their issue. I mean, like, clearly Facebook is not going to have issues monetizing. That being said, the way that they've been valued and the way that people have invested in them are expecting, you know, much, much, much higher returns. And honestly, given the level of interaction they have and the number of people they have, like, they're, like, barely, you know, doing much in terms of, you know, really leveraging the value of that network that they have. That's always been my worry about Facebook, especially a couple years ago. I remember saying it on the Symbiotic podcast a lot, is my worry about Facebook was whether or not they could actually convert on the value that they built, or whether or not it was just a lucky, you know, they happened to be here at the right time.
Speaking of Facebook, the billionaire founder of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, has launched a new initiative to push for immigration reform, describing America's current system as, quote, unfit for today's world. The group called Forward Us is backed by other Silicon Valley leaders, including Google chairman Eric Schmidt, Yahoo boss Marissa Mayer, and Reid Hoffman, the billionaire co-founder of LinkedIn. We have a strange immigration policy for a nation of immigrants, and it's a policy unfit for today's world, Zuckerberg wrote in an editorial for the Washington Post. To lead the world in this new economy, we need the most talented and hardest working people. We need to train and attract the best. We need those middle school students to be tomorrow's leaders. Given all this, why do we kick out the more than 40% of math and science graduate students who are not U.S. citizens after educating them? Zuckerberg said that Forward Us would push for comprehensive immigration reform that begins with effective border security, allows a path to citizenship, and lets us attract the most talented and hardest working people no matter where they were born, higher standards and accountability in schools, support for good teachers, and a much greater focus on learning about science, technology, engineering, and math, investment in breakthrough discoveries in scientific research, and assurance that benefits of the inventions belong to the public and not just the few. Chris, as someone who has a startup himself, do you find getting good members of the team is difficult because you're hampered by?
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. Like, and it's not even. I mean, so like, you know, it's not like we're even necessarily looking abroad. So I mean. How to start this. So Startup Digest was definitely an international organization. Like we had, I guess we still do have, like, you know, 180 cities, and at least almost half of them are international cities. You know, it was so when we were, you know, looking to hire people or hire interns or whatever, you know, like we would have people who would contact us who were not necessarily from the US and who wanted to you know, come in and work. And we've actually tried to hire, between GroupTie and Startup Digest, two internationals. One was from Hong Kong, the other was from Canada. And it was just an absolute mess. And we, you know, couldn't even come close. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were eventually able to, you know, fill those spots and find people. But, you know, they would have been good people. They would have been really good. And, you know, they were both educated in the U.S. and they were both in the U.S. at the time. You know, and I think Zuckerberg has a great point there when he talks about how, you know, a lot of people in the U.S., they're making value for the U.S., or they've even, like, benefited substantially from U.S.'s educational system. And then rather than getting a return on our investment from that, we just kick them out. We're like, oh, no jobs for you. And I think, like, you know, especially with these sorts of, like, high-tech jobs, like, these people are value creators. Like, right. Having the right engineer in the first, like, 10 to 20 of your company, you know, as the 200th engineer of your company, like, that has, like, a ripple effect in terms of all the other, you know, economic activity that you create. Like, a good, you know, person creating that value is going to create so many other economic opportunities, you know, for everyone else in the area, or even not in the area. I mean, Facebook creates value for people who don't live in Silicon Valley, and they create, right. You know, all the additional, you know, jobs and the additional, you know, content and companies that spring up around Facebook. Like, there's just so much value. And there was a study from the Kauffman Foundation, like, last year or something, that, like, something like, I think 80%, I don't know, don't quote me on this number, but most of the new jobs that are created by new companies, not by existing companies. Like, existing companies hire people, but usually they're just moving people around or moving stuff around. It's only companies that are new that are generally growing fast enough to actually be creating new jobs rather than simply, you know, repurposing old ones. Yeah, it's the level that people have gone to sort of work around the immigration system here is, I think, also a sign of just how messed up it is. There's somebody who's, like, planning on buying a boat and, like, parking it, like, 20 miles off of San Francisco, right on international waters, and just having, like, the brightest people live on a cruise ship for a couple months at a time, and then occasionally come on, you know, to U.S. as tourists, so to speak. And, like, just it's just sad. Like, you know, I have a friend who's, you know, her husband has a visa, but she doesn't, and she's a super smart, talented engineer, who would benefit any company that could hire her, but they can't because it's just too much of a pain to go through the process of hiring. Mm. Right now the system also really benefits the established players. Like, it's much easier if you're Yahoo or eBay to go through the process of hiring somebody. Whereas if you're a startup, you know, you really just, you have to basically stick with, you know, people who are nationals because you just simply can't. Right. Go through the process well enough of, you know. So, yeah, I know this is something I'm very passionate about.
Well, for the sake of the issue itself, I'm a little torn on this because, I mean, absolutely, I think we should get, first of all, we should get the best and the brightest no matter where they come from. I really do believe in that. But, I mean, on the other hand, there's a slightly conservative side of me that says, why are we not giving the, you know, making it so that those jobs can go to people who are already here in the country? Like, why aren't we fighting for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of tech people, we're just simply looking at it from the, like, we have a need. This is where the need can be met, but this current system is not making that. I mean, I think there's a deeper problem. I mean, they're always talking in education about STEM, sure. Science, technology, engineering, math. And I think one of the problems is that the U.S. is just not producing enough really high-quality STEM graduates to fill the needs that the U.S. has.
That's really the crux of the problem, isn't it? Is that we need to sort of focus on that.
Or even worse, as Zuckerberg has said, we are creating those graduates. But if those graduates are American citizens, then those, like, I mean, just to speak purely evilly for a second, like, totally, like, opportunistically rather than, you know, whatever, like, it's almost a sense in which, like, if we're not going to let them have jobs here, like, then we should let those graduate programs be, you know, taken in more by, you know, non, by nationals rather than internationals. Yeah. I mean, you know, like that's kind of a waste of that education. And, you know, it's kind of sad to say, well, we are producing the right number of graduates, but if they're not our graduates, then we can't hire them.
Right.
Yeah, I know. That was a big thing that Reid Hoffman was, and oh my gosh, who's the CEO of LinkedIn while I was there? Jeff Weiner. LinkedIn hosted Obama during the time that I was there, and one of the big things that Jeff Weiner was pointing out is that there are two job crises in the country right now. One is the fact that there's not enough jobs, and there are tons of people who are unemployed. There are also lots of jobs that are unfulfilled. There are people who would like to hire and simply cannot find people with the necessary skills in their area to do that. Obviously, that's a much bigger issue than just immigration, but I think immigration sort of falls into it a little bit. And I don't know, I'm not enough of an economist to really comment on it, but it is an interesting conundrum to be in.
Well, I hope one way or the other, I hope it gets sorted out. I mean, I think I would definitely love to see some sort of reform, because I think he's right. There are definitely some problems, regardless of to what end those reforms fix, you know. And I can see there's definitely sort of you know, Zuckerberg has ulterior motives for wanting to fix this problem, because I'm sure he wants the best and the brightest minds at Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so do, you know, Eric Schmidt and Marissa Mayer and Reid Hoffman, I'm sure.
Yeah. There's definitely ulterior motives here. I don't even think you can say ulterior. I mean, I think it's pretty clear what their motives are. Yeah. It's hard to say if it's ulterior. I'm not sure what the fake motive is. Like, it's pretty clear they want to hire people.
All right, let's move on here. Twitter's new music site went live this week. Well, almost. Users can currently log in with their usual Twitter credentials, but there are no features as of yet. According to All Things D, only a select few will get access to the service over the coming days, with Twitter planning a more extensive rollout after that. Rumors says that it's going to be this Friday, which is when you should be hearing this show. So by the time you hear this episode, Twitter's new music site should roll out to the public. Reports that the service was set to go live began circulating last week and were fueled earlier in the week by celebrity Ryan Seacrest, who bragged about having access to it in a series of tweets. Apparently, the people who do have access to it it's a limited number of like celebrities and high profile Twitter users, which is
a really strange way of doing it. Like, has Twitter heard of? There's this cool technology. It's called a waiting list. Like, you sign up and then you get notified when you're going to get it, as opposed to this, which is just nothing. Like, you go there, it says Twitter coming soon, music. You click sign in and it redirects you back to the application, and then Twitter coming soon, music. Like,
I think they're expecting that all the celebrity users are going to build some sort of a hype for it, and that people will want to sign on and then just wait to see to be the first to use the same music discovery service that Ryan Seacrest is using for some reason. So,
yeah, I guess they're sort of hoping, but it's still, I mean, I don't understand why bother making the page with the sign up thing at all.
Right.
If you're not going to make it like, it, you know, some sort of counter or just something. I don't know. It's very strange. I'm excited for it, I guess. Yeah. I mean, Twitter, this is definitely Twitter's like market, you know, like Twitter has really become successful, I think, in two sort of areas. Twitter is successful in like relatively tight knit groups, like the tech community, the journalism community, you know, groups that sort of everyone follows themselves, or sort of a dense network of following. Mm-hmm. But honestly, what really makes Twitter is the asymmetry of the relationship they're in. The fact that, you know, Lady Gaga and Bieber and, right, you know, Obama, you know, can interact directly with, you know, people that like, and, you know, for music, I mean, that's a perfect example of that. And it's something, you know, scales from, you know, we're in a garage band trying to build interest all the way up to, you know, we're Muse. So
I'm seeing on the at Twitter Music Twitter account, I'm seeing people like Imagine Dragons, Pitbull, Nikki Sixx, Moby, Jason Mraz, Ne-Yo, Wiz Khalifa. They're all talking about how they're blown away by the new Twitter Music service that you can't have access to, essentially.
So, no music for you. Wait, how do you find that?
It's twitter.com/twittermusic. It's all one.
Yeah, because somebody else has twitter.com/music, which is kind of awesome. Twitter can't even get their own.
Well, sorry, they probably were never expecting. Like, who knew they were going to get into music?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Twitter Music. Oh, there we go. Oh, that actually looks more professional. That's pretty cool. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see where they go. I kind of like Twitter's cards idea, even though I'm not entirely clear on it. It does seem like some cool sort of additional interaction on there. Did you guys talk about the shutting down of that payments service on Twitter?
No.
Let me just look up who it was. Twitter shut down payment. This is definitely sort of gets into the Twitter evil. Was it Flatter? No, it couldn't have been Flatter.
What, did they shut it down because they were developing a service a lot like it, and it was entrenching on their service? Because that seems like something. That sounds like something that Apple would do.
Well, I mean, it was with typical Twitter fashion. You don't really know why it was cut off. I mean, honestly, did you guys talk about the app gratis thing too?
The whole Apple thing with the, no, we did not. We didn't cover that one.
I guess these are more like start. I never know exactly when things are startup versus tech issues, but, yeah, I mean, Twitter, there was, a service called Ribbon, which was a really cool, like, payment service. It basically allowed you to fill out, it basically used the interactive Twitter cards to allow you to fill out payment information and make payments in the Twitter stream. Like, you don't have to click on another link. You literally are doing it right from the tweet using the sort of interactive card technology. And it got featured on TechCrunch, and then like a day later it was shut down by Twitter. And apparently Flatter has had some issues too. Oh, so it looks like Twitter is, I don't know if this is just Twitter like wanting to shut down anything that looks like a good business idea on their platform because they could have it, right, or if they actually were working on something. But either way, it just kind of, I don't know, kind of a dick.
So you can thing to do. The bottom line is that the key to this is you can have success on Twitter and on Apple as long as you aren't too successful.
Yeah, exactly. As long as you're not, or unless you have like some, like, yeah, I don't know. Basically, as long as you're not too successful. Yeah. Unless your success is somehow big enough that you can sort of like spin it off into your own identity.
Right.
You know? But
right.
This is sort of, I mean, I guess it's really the platform problem. Like, it's the same problem that happened back when Windows was the primary platform that, you know, companies like Netscape that were super, super, super successful, or Lotus or anything else built that platform, Microsoft would be like, ah, yes, we're going to do this. Now, as long as you were like one of the smaller players or in a niche market, you could go. But, you know, as soon as Microsoft decided they wanted to move, it's the problem of just sort of building on somebody else's platform.
Exactly.
Like, you.
Exactly.
And it's hard because, like, at the same time, like, you have to build on some platform, right? I mean, like, even Microsoft is building on Intel's platform, and Intel is building on, you know, the platform of the, well, the, I don't know what some Windows platform was, maybe because they're hardware, they are by definition a platform, but nevertheless, like, you know, platforms give you distribution, they give you, you know, consistency, and they ensure that you're going to interoperate with things. You know, there's a lot of good things about platforms, but you have to also realize you're taking a risk when you do a platform.
Exactly. Exactly. A lesson many startups have learned the hard way, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Let's move on here. Smartphones, tablets, and computers all pull data from the internet, but people still pay two different bills, the high-speed connection they get at home and the wireless connection they get outside. Dish Network, the pay TV operator, wants to bridge that gap. Dish said on Monday that it had submitted a $25.5 billion bid for Sprint Nextel, the nation's third largest wireless carrier after Verizon Wireless and AT&T. It says a merger between the two companies could roll television, high-speed internet, and cell phone services into a single package that would be faster and more affordable for customers. Dish's network bid is an effort to scuttle the planned takeover of Sprint Nextel by the Japanese telecommunications company SoftBank, which agreed in October to acquire a 70% stake of the of Sprint in a complex deal worth about $20 billion. Dish Network said it would be able to combine its existing broadband and TV offerings with Sprint Nextel's cell phone operations, allowing it to better compete with rivals like Verizon that are moving in new areas into new areas in search of revenue. So what do you think about this? Is Dish, like, when I first read about this, the first thing I thought of is, okay, Dish's core business is kind of going away, and so it's looking for a way to continue to extend itself, and in that manner, maybe buying a mobile provider is its way of creating some sort of longevity for itself.
Yeah, I think that's exactly there. I mean, Dish realizes that, you know, their core competency is streaming information from satellites. Yep. Limited use for that. And I think they realize, you know, they still have a lot of, you know, they have all these antennas around everything. Yeah, I think it's an interesting idea. I'm not exactly sure where they'd go with it, but it's one of those situations where both companies are definitely struggling a little bit, but I wouldn't say that either of them is sick enough that it's going to be like a disaster, you know, like this isn't HP buying Palm when Palm was just desperate, or something like that. I mean, unfortunately, like Sprint isn't big enough for me that I would love it that much. And I mean, you know, for me, like TV is just not important. Like I don't care about TV, and actually it's amazing for me how many people out here just don't have
well, because everyone has cut the cord, right?
Yeah, because, still it's not for any like lack programs. Of yeah, it's just there's just no need for it, and like right. It's, you know, it's amazing. It's like it's not like because of even the cost anymore. Like, you know, some of the more senior engineers I know at Google, they're definitely not struggling for, you know, few extra dollars per month, but it's just like, yeah, it's just not that important.
There is still kind of a cost, though, right?
We're joined by Duane DeFreitas.
Hi guys,
how you doing? So, fine, Duane, thanks. We're talking about the Sprint,
the Sprint Dish merger, exactly.
The Dish bid for Sprint.
Yeah. So the thing about the cost is that the cost is, when it comes to cable, it's not even that the cost is the payment to the cable company every month or whatever for the TV service. I think the big difference is that we're seeing a shift where people are interested in watching TV shows, but they're not interested in watching TV. That is to say, people will say, okay, I'm going to pay for Netflix, or I'll even pay for HBO a la carte. I'm willing to pay for everything I want a la carte and actually spend more money. What I don't want is to have some mishmash of basic cable programming on a box that forces me to sort of do that thing where I channel surf and I go looking for programming that I might be interested in when I'm bored. Instead, I'd rather focus on what I know I like and watch that, and watch it to the exclusion of everything else. See what's highly recommended, purchase that experience, and television suddenly becomes a lot like how music becomes, with this not quite iTunes situation, but this idea that I only want this one bit. I only want this one album, this one TV show, this one series, this one season. I don't really want you know, the overhead of having to like sort through television as it's provided by the cable companies, and sort through, you know, going through the random TV shows that exist in between the actual good bits of stuff. So I feel like that's the cost. The cost is the overhead of having to think about having to not have a curated experience, and people just would rather have that. And what Dish is doing is they're saying, look, we understand that people want what they want when they want it. So that's why we have the Sling Box attached to our service. And that's why we're looking at the Sprint company, because we can get that wireless network and we can deliver the good programming to these people directly on a device that we control, with a network that we control. So they're not even thinking about cost, like bandwidth type costs and things like that. So I think there's something interesting from that perspective of looking at it. But it's really it seems really unconventional until you think about the way Verizon provides both cellular services and television services.
Yeah. Right, right. I think they're really sort of following the Verizon model here in intentions for Sprint.
Right, and I think they kind of have a certain level of integration that would probably go above and beyond what Verizon is doing right now.
Yeah.
Verizon may have a triple play or a quadruple play, landline, cell phone, internet, and television. But I think what Dish has shown us with their use of the Sling technology is that they want you to be able to gain access to the programming that would otherwise be on your TV anywhere you want it, as long as you have a connection. So if you can Sling Dish to your phone on their network.
Oh, I see now. That definitely makes – I see that.
Yeah. So they're looking for a truly integrated solution to the content receiving experience. That's what I think this merge is about. And they think that they can get ahead that way. They can get that person who's a little savvy about technology, or that person who thinks a bit before they go and they buy, because they're like, hey, I can get this total experience. Now they're going to have to do some work. Sprint has a slow network, according to a lot of sources. What's that going to do when it comes to all these people streaming in bandwidth? We don't know. But it's a start, and it positions them in a pretty unique place.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. I sort of hadn't thought about that angle. But you know, they already have those licensing deals and content deals and relationships with, you know, good content as part of, you know, their place as the satellite provider. And now they can combine that with other distribution methods. That's kind of cool.
Exactly. And they're all wireless too, which is interesting, right? Like,
yeah. Well, that's the way everything is going, mobile.
Sure, they're kind of ahead of the game in that respect. You know, they are satellite, which means they're not cable oriented directly, and now they're looking for a wireless telephone company, a wireless data network to possibly be the backbone of that. You know, it's interesting.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways to look at it that are interesting.
Let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I want to recommend this week is called The World as I See It by Albert Einstein. In the aftermath of the First World War, Einstein writes about his hopes for the League of Nations, his feelings as a German citizen about the growing anti-Semitism and nationalism of his country, and his myriad opinions about the current affairs of his day. In addition to these political perspectives, The World as I See It reveals the idealistic, spiritual, and witty side of this great intellectual as he approaches topics including good and evil, religion and science, active pacifism, Christianity and Judaism, and minorities. Including letters, speeches, articles, and essays written before 1935, this collection offers a complete portrait of Einstein as a humanitarian and as a human being trying to make sense of the changing world around him. And what interested me in choosing this for this week is that theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking is making the tour rounds, and he spoke last night at MIT here in Pasadena, California. So I thought it would be an interesting thing to tie into that. So that book, or any one of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, can be yours for free by giving this service a try. And even if you don't like the service, even if you want to quit out of it, you're done with it, you get to keep the book that you chose for free. So to download that free audiobook or any of those other any of Audible's other library of titles. All you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out that service. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, why the future of Google could look a lot like Star Trek. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Christopher Brunor, and now Dwayne DeFreitas has joined us. How's it going, Dwayne?
It's going pretty well.
All right. So a couple weeks ago, we talked about Google Glass. We talked about Google Glass for like 2 or 3 consecutive episodes on the show because it was just, you know, blowing up all over the place. So the news about Google Glass just keeps coming. After announcing that Glass is about to ship and releasing the Glass Mirror API documentation, Google has now also posted the full spec sheet for the Glass hardware. Glass will work with any Bluetooth-capable phone, but it looks like the only way to use GPS and SMS through Glass at this point is through their My Glass Companion app, which requires Android 4.0.3. The display, which is obviously the highlight of the devices, will have a resolution that is, quote, the equivalent of a 25-inch high-definition screen from 8 feet away, unquote. In its developer guides, Google says the photos should have a 640 by 360 pixel resolution, so it's probably also the resolution of the Glass display, though Google, interestingly, does not note this in the specs. The first version of Glass will also feature a 5-megapixel camera that can also do 720p video. Glass will come with 16 gigs of flash storage, of which 12 gigs will be usable and synced with Google's cloud storage service. The company says that the device should have enough battery power to last a full day, quote, of typical use, but it also warns that features like Hangouts and video recordings are more battery intensive. The coolest feature, however, is probably the bone conduction transducer.
I had to look up what that was. It sounds awesome.
It sounds like that you're... Does that make – I mean, I glanced over that line, and I'm thinking, does that make your bones the antenna?
No. It makes your bones the speaker, essentially. It transmits sound from Glass to the inner ear through the bones of the wearer's skull. So
that's a patent.
Because of that, users won't have to use a regular headphone to use Glass. It might be a patent, but I remember – like, this goes way back, way before – anybody else sitting here at this panel. But way back in the day, there used to be a radio that you could buy that was literally called the bone phone. And you would wrap it around you like a shawl, and the music would be transmitted through your collarbones, essentially. So you'd hear the music through your bones into your ear bones, essentially.
I wonder what the long term, if there's any long term like problem there, because as a person, like, I have arthritis, and as a person who manages arthritis, the idea that something is going to be sonically rattling your bones as you use it all day every day for however long you're using it is not appealing. That said, Google Glass is probably worth it.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's going to be rattling your bones like at a, you know, it's not like you're going to be at a electronica concert. It's not that.
No, that's true. But it's just like if you're a fancy bank thief and you steal one penny or one tenth of a penny from every single transaction, it adds up.
Right.
So I wonder if there's any long term thing there. I'm not saying that there is. It just doesn't. doesn't sound appealing. But then again, Google Glass, now that we've seen some serious specs, that it's out there, I can actually be excited about it. you know, I could see myself being like, well, maybe a couple days a week. But yeah, this is these specifications, this rollout, this is very good news, because I'm going to say it again. Google Glass was vaporware until this existed, until this showed up.
Until
the spec sheets showed up, and the fact that it was rolled out to enough people to begin to form consensus about what was possible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the spec sheet is something that is indicative of a real piece of hardware.
Yeah.
It's not this could do that. It's like, this is how you would implement this. This is how the API works. You know, these are things that are based on a piece of hardware and the accompanying software that is actual, right? Like, you can't make this stuff up. And I'm not saying they were making up stuff before, but there was just no way to tell how far along they had come, and thus no way to gauge how serious an impact this would be on the types of stuff that we typically talk about on the show.
Yeah, I've seen a couple people with them around. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's true vaporware. I mean, there are pictures of Larry and Sergey wearing them, and at least one of my coworkers said he saw some guy wearing one on a date on Valentine's Day.
But it's all that kind of stuff. It's not like peer reviewed with specs laid out for people to see and understand. It's like, oh, the people who own it are wearing it. Oh, the people who own it are letting one guy from one tech company, The Verge, talk about it when they produce videos around it. You know what I mean? It's not like in the raw. And having the spec sheet out allows for a new level of scrutiny that can get us to a place where we can begin to see what this thing is capable of. The next step, that's what's exciting. The next step is obviously having it peer reviewed, just like any bit of technology or any like research that's ever happened. Having independent people, like anything as silly as your local news broadcast, to, you know, having the gamut of tech and regular top journalists go through it and say, this is what I can do with it, this is what I can't do with it, this is what they promise, this is what it delivers.
Yeah.
That's what I'm excited for next. But I think that can finally begin to happen now, because the software has been spec'd out. The hardware has been spec'd out. And unless Google is pulling off some crazy...
some major hoax.
Yeah, some major hoax in order to get the share price back to $834. I feel like I can be excited. So.
Yeah. You know, this sort of reminds me of, like, old hardware stuff. Like, I had a friend in high school who, like, would, like, before it was cool to have mobile computing, was doing mobile computing. And when I say before it was cool, I mean it really was not cool. Like, he had, like, his little Palm Pilot and, like, a little keyboard, and would take notes in class on a keyboard and Palm Pilot. And, like,
this is, like, pre-handspring.
This is like 1999.
Okay, so this is the handspring era. You're like, yeah, that sucks.
Yeah, it was. He got a lot of crap for it and everything. And, like, I think that's what Google is hoping is going on here. I mean, because there's the biggest issue for me with Google Glass has never been, can Google deliver on it? It's been, is this a thing that people are going to pay money for in any sort of numbers that makes it worth it? You know, like...
Well, at this price point, it has to be for that geek. It has to be for the person that would have been a dweeb in the 90s, would have been a nerd in the early part of the century, and now has become a geek. And geek is, like, as chic as it can be. It has to be for that super enthusiast, that relative technology extremist who wants to pay $1,200 for an experience that is, at best, not fully baked, and at worst, truly problematic. And to boot, it's... You know, you have to be a relative extremist in order to put on something that looks like this, to walk around town and to have the confidence. Now, we have a bigger geek culture now. You know, a lot of people are coming out of school, college, whatever, and they are coding. They understand the technology. We all have computers in our pockets. So Google Glass is going to be accepted a lot more than the handspring visor with the attachments in the back. Because people will know what it is. Google's done a good job of saying this is what it is. We talked about how it might rattle a little some aspects of society, but to be honest, because of the price point alone, there's going to be a certain status associated with it,
mm-hmm,
and there's going to be And that status is not just going to be like, I'm fancy, I can buy a fancy car, I can buy these fancy glasses. It's also going to be, I am working. Like, you know, the only people who get it are people who, like, you know, they are going to supposed to develop on it. I'm that level of developer. I'm that much of a tinkerer. And I think that there's something to that. But it is a little weird.
I mean, the thing is that there have been plenty of devices that did not make it past that. I mean, even still, like, you know, there are certain, like, high-end sound system things that they're never going to go mainstream. You know, flat-screen TVs ended up going mainstream, but 5.1 in sound is not that. Yeah, but I just don't – I mean, there's some of the technologies that have been around for 20 or 30 years that
it's like
only
laser
my
disc.
Hey, LaserDisc is still pretty cool.
I see what you're saying, though. There are things that have not caught on. And this is why you look at the alliance with Warby Parker and you begin to understand that perhaps this is how they're going to figure out how to roll this out to the mainstream. Because the mainstream, unlikely, once a device – unless they're doing some sort of specialty work, you know. You mentioned Star Trek at the top of the segment. When Dr. Crusher is looking through trying to look at somebody's like bones under their skin, then a specialty visor is in order. But for the regular everyday thing, we're moving toward a place where the technology is far more subtle. You know, you don't notice the technology. You want a Bluetooth ear thing that fits directly in your ear so no one sees it. You want a Fitbit that no one can tell, which is why it's been beating things like the Nike Fuel Band, which is sort of like on your wrist for everybody to see, like jewelry. You want things to be as subtle as possible. So if they can take the glass and apply it to individuals who like wear normal glasses, then we're going to see it pick up a lot more quickly than if just rich people start wearing Google Glass.
Yeah.
Let's move on here. Speaking of Google, Google making progress here, and pushing the envelope. The city of Provo, Utah, is the next home for Google Fiber. It was announced today. News comes a little over a week after Google announced its intentions to build a fiber network in Austin, Texas. The deal still awaits approval from the Provo City Council, as well as more details from Google on the rollout, including pricing and the deployment. Provo already has its own fiber network. Google says it'll provide its free internet service to every home along the existing Provo network for a $30 activation fee and no monthly charge for at least 7 years. The Kansas City service was provided free with a $300 connection charge. Google's announcement is significant for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that Google is planning to keep pushing its gigabit network to more places. It's already building a fiber to the network home in Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri, but it also signifies the changing cost-benefit equation that municipalities and private companies are facing when it comes to fiber-to-the-home networks. More municipalities from North Carolina to Seattle are trying to entice gigabit networks using a combination of leasing existing city assets or tax breaks for newcomers. Companies like Google and Gigabit Squared are trying to take advantage of the willingness of city officials to deal and the underlying assets of those cities. But even companies like AT&T and Time Warner Cable are also starting to play ball. So I think as Google starts to roll out their fiber to more and more cities, it's going to be a combination of the city itself, the community itself, and the already existing infrastructure that the community has or what they're willing to put into it to meet Google half part way on the deal.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what Kansas City had before Google got there, but the fact that Google is going to be off delivering the service on a network that partially or fully already exists is probably a big part of the reason why the cost is so low. Also, Provo is not as big as Kansas City by any stretch of the imagination. So the cost per home, you know, they don't have to roll out as big infrastructure. So that's going to be a little less. And then you have to look at the fact that these cities – in today's economy, we realize that it's not necessarily about, you know, getting that manufacturing plant in your place, right? In your locality. It's very much about the connectivity you have with the outside world that will keep people in your city, if you're a smaller city, and allow them to get the jobs wherever they are through telecommunication. So telecommunication needs to not be a burden, needs to be a utility that's completely reliable. and having Google back your town might even get businesses to come through and set up shop because they know that they're going to have that reliable telecommunication. There's a big pipe there. They're not all going to suffer from tiny issues. It's one of those things.
I'm still curious to find out what Google's long-term strategy. I mean, maybe Google just doesn't have a long-term strategy when it comes to Google Fiber. Like, I'd be really surprised if they ended up being a, you know, full-on
telecommunication company.
Yeah, but at the same time,
what did we just talk about with Dish and Sprint?
Yeah, I know. It just,
and then let's take a look at the fact that YouTube has shows. Google is producing, not quite producing, but Google is working with people, production companies, to make unique content for their service. Google likes to hold on to the data to attract and attract usage for the purposes of storing data and then using that data to leverage relationships with advertisers and so on and so forth, and products, make products better by knowing who you are and what you're interested in. So if you're Google and your job is to organize all this information, remember that there was do no harm and then organize all the information in the world or whatever. Part of that is if you can control the network in addition to the devices, then you're getting a whole bunch of completely integrated data. You're making a walled garden that's highly effective in terms of getting what you understanding who your customer is, so you can get more to them, you know, for better or for worse. So I'm not sure that they're going to be a telco, but it's not like it would be the worst thing in the world considering their current business model. And remember, they're always chasing something other than search. Search is where they started, and search is where people get down on them for. It's these different initiatives. It's things like moving into telco. It's things like, you know, Android, even though they're not making as much money as Apple on the OS or whatever. It's things like that keep the stock price from slipping for fear that someone's going to come up and usurp their search algorithm and disrupt their entire business model.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting having this discussion. I'm realizing, like, how many points along the whole supply chain Google has actually covered. That, you know, from YouTube, they've got the content covered. Here they've got the delivery to the home, to the end user covered. And then all along the way, they've got little, you know, bits and pieces of the chain covered in this long sort of, like, they're a fully realized company.
Vertically integrated delivery service.
Vertical integrated, yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the thing is, remember, there was a time when Google was trying to get Spectrum. And Verizon had to make a deal with them saying, hey, give us the Spectrum. We'll make sure that we can get you can get devices on the Spectrum. But there was a time when Google was looking. We don't know if it was just a savvy business ploy or if it was legitimate concern, but they were looking for Spectrum, for wireless Spectrum with which to work on devices. So it's unclear whether their strategy is completely pivoted or what's going on. One thing's for sure. They are in love with mobile. They're dedicated to mobile, to social integration on that mobile, to the Plus system. And if they can control the network, even if a little bit, these experiments will tell them what the benefits of having a network of, you know, their own network is. And that'll inform them as to how to move forward.
We do have a little bit of a hint as to what their strategy is with search. And it appears that strategy is to go boldly where no man has gone before.
Oh, Andy, that was good. That was good.
Transition ward of the show.
Farhad Manju in Slate this week writes about Google's obsession with becoming the computer in Star Trek. I'm going to read a little bit of his article. It's really fascinating, the sort of big picture of that he's painting here. He says, I first came across Google's interest in Star Trek back in the summer of 2010. A company spokesman wanted to show me the firm's rapidly improving visual search and speech recognition technology. So when the spokesman told me that he regarded the latest Android devices as something like a combination of Star Trek's tricorder and the Enterprise's computer, I dismissed it as a gimmick to attract media attention. Since then, though, Star Trek has popped up again and again in my interviews with Googlers. Last year, for a piece in which I praised Google's voice search for chouncing Apple Siri, I spoke to Scott Huffman, one of the engineering directors on Google's search team, When I asked him how he pictured voice search evolving, he too invoked the Star Trek computer. A few weeks ago, I was chatting with Tamar Yehoshua, Director of Product Management on Google Search. Is there a roadmap for how search will look a few years from now? I asked her. Our vision is the Star Trek computer, she shot back with a smile. You can talk to it, it understands you, and it can have a conversation with you. Still, I didn't really put much stock into these references. After all, Google is very likely the nerdiest large company on Earth, and of course its employees are going to like Star Trek. Then, in March, Amit Singhal, who heads Google's search ranking teams, gave a talk at South by Southwest, and Star Trek took center stage. Singhal told the audience that the original series was one of his all-time favorite shows, and he longed one day to meet William Shatner. Then he added, quote, "The destiny of Google's search engine is to become that Star Trek computer, and that's what we're building," end quote. Okay, really? Despite all the interviews in which Star Trek had come up, I'd long assumed that Google's Star Trek chatter was meant as marketing. But Singhal's talk got me wondering, what if Google's vision really is to build the Star Trek computer? What if the picture most of us have of search, type in a few keywords, get back links to other sites, is not the way Google thinks about search? What if, when Google search engineers go about building the next iteration of the company's primary product, they really do look to Captain Kirk for inspiration?
So I gotta say, guys, yeah. I feel like I'm surprised that Manju is so surprised at this.
Like, yeah, for you guys, it seems so fairly obvious.
Well, it's I don't know if I'd call it fairly obvious, but let's take a look at what we have. Let's take a look at the data. When you look down at that GPS representation of where you are on a Google map, that is almost exactly like the representation that we got when we used to play D&D with the map on the ground, right? When you look at the way the GPS even takes you when you're doing the driving style GPS, the 3D or whatever, that's based on that looks so much like the games that we used to play in the 90s. The people who are making this technology are the people who are the dreamers, who are looking at the content that outlined possible ways of the future. Even think about the web. Up to a few years ago, if you were a systems administrator, you were a webmaster. To date, we still use terms like domain. Why? Because of the geeks that were playing D&D and other things that use that terminology to understand the paradigms of the virtual world. And when you look at the computer and how we use the computer and how we want to use the computer and how we move to it, you know, Star Trek is the natural progression. Look at the cell phones we've had. You know, how long ago, you know, 10 years ago, in 2003, the flip phone, the communicator from the original Star Trek, was the paradigm for a phone. It didn't come out of nowhere. It came because this series especially has been able to give us insight into ways technology can work that is both ergonomic, stylistic, and useful, and truly non-invasive, as opposed to sort of like the 2001 Space Odyssey, the computer is, you know, built into this big ship and everything like that. Now, Star Trek has a computer built into the ship, but it's seamless. If you go to the next generation, the L-Car system, you open your mouth and you talk to it, and Majel Barrett talks back to you. And I think it's strange that someone who's so tied into technology would not see the parallels between all the other paradigms of technology and the way we're using computers. I think that to me is almost more of a story than Google saying we want to move toward a Star Trek style computer. Star Trek style is the way it's the intuitive way that most people would see it going. And when you have Siri, for instance, I'm most surprised that it doesn't exist in Macs, because who doesn't want to walk and talk to who doesn't want to walk into their house and talk to their computer and say whatever. So I get that there's obviously a little kitsch here and you can play around with it, but I think that this is intuitive, moving toward the Star Trek paradigm. And I think that's what Siri's trying to do as well, not just Google.
Yeah, I think, in one sense, I think this is a story of, like, I mean, people always talk about how good science fiction is at predicting the future. And it's not because science fiction writers are great at predicting the future. It's because everyone reads science fiction and then goes out and builds it. there are definitely things that are better at predicting than others. That being said, I think it is a cool, like, sense of Google's vision that Google sees more broadly focused than simply, you know, search or product. I mean, I think that's the sense of a really great company, is a company that doesn't just have a product, they have a vision. They have something, you know, that's far beyond what any of them will be able to do in their lifetimes. It's not unlike Ford. You know, I mean, Ford in various senses is still living out Ford's original vision to, you know, build high quality cars for everyone to really, you know, sort of revolutionize transportation. Obviously, it's not nearly as exciting of a vision to have anymore, but they're still living through to it.
I see what you're saying. Like, it's totally there. And even if you look at Google's other products, you just talked about Glass. I mean, who hasn't seen Aliens, the second of the original Alien trilogy series, mm-hmm. where the individuals had a wireless feed from their goggles back to the right. base, where people could see them in real time and what they were doing and what they were up against. And Google Glass allows some of that too, right? So there's another example of taking science fiction and moving it forward. And when you look at science fiction writers, what the good ones were able to do is not just sit there and like wax poetic about what could be. They looked at the trends that existed that day. They looked at the trends that, you know, and how those things can move forward. And they made something that was over the cliff of possibility, but enough for people to be interested and want to grab on. And then those people take that and they innovate on top of that paradigm. So it's this cycle, you know? And I think that's one of the things that makes this intuitive, you know? It's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I for one, cannot wait to see how Google, you know, edges closer and closer to the Star Trek computer. I it's amazing. Like, basically, what I think, Chris, it was what you said at the top of this conversation is dead on. People build the future in the image of what they've seen from, you know, from the past, from science fiction. So we've already seen, you know, essentially, you know, Star Trek, the original series had iPads before, you know, years before, decades before they were a reality. They invented.
And when you look at Star Trek in the Next Generation, Apple Computer supplied the graphics for the LCAR system, the touchscreen system mm-hmm. that seems so magical in there. So again, it plays on each other. We got to get somebody in here to help us figure out what's going to happen in the future. Apple Computer comes in, lays out this paradigm. The paradigm happens. People get used to it. Apple Computer comes out with, or Apple Inc. now, comes out with a device that's handheld that has this paradigm. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
It just kind of goes over. It's a cycle. And
self-fulfilling prophecy.
It's one that, you know, it takes smart people to figure out how to do things and then how to lay things out. And then we get used to it culturally. And that's why things become a phenomenon. It's all over. Think about that car, Google's car. I mean, that's just like going in. I mean, that's science fiction right there. Right. Getting in your car and seeing it go. I mean, who didn't see iRobot or
Minority Report,
where the car takes you where you want to go. I mean, these are the things that the reason why science fiction is exciting to people who love science fiction is because it talks about cool stuff, the stuff that you want. And when you can begin to get there, I mean, we're sitting here talking about this. Meanwhile, Microsoft came out with the Kinect, which has the other Minority Report aspect with the hand moving and moving stuff together. So, you know, science fiction is a leader. It's a thought leader.
Yep. That's a great way of putting it. Okay, so those are our headlines. And before we leave, let's talk about the viral video of the week. So the one I've chosen for this week is iSteve, which bills itself as not the best, but the first Steve Jobs movie. And technically, that's correct if you don't count the one that had a limited screening at Sundance. Or I can't remember what. I think it was Sundance. Might have been a different film festival. But this is Funny or Die's own homebrew parody biopic featuring Justin Long as Steve Jobs. And it is incredibly, like, if you know just I watched this last night. It's like it runs like 80 minutes long. It's not a very long movie. But if you know even the
Funny or Die put together an 80-minute long
yes.
piece of content, that is a story.
Yeah, it's the first, like, I think it's the first feature-length project for Funny or Die. And it's like, if you know even the slightest a bit about the Steve Jobs, like, legend, the history, you'll get a kick out of this because intentionally inaccurate in so many different ways, but accurate enough that it follows kind of the basic story along. But like, there's so many just amazing inaccuracies. Like one of the subplots of the story is a love triangle between Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and Melinda French Gates. Going back to their childhood, and obviously Melinda Gates didn't know.
That's so Ready Player One, though.
Yeah.
If you read Ready Player One, that's exactly what happens in the book. That's hilarious. I mean, we're able to take an idea like that and run with it.
Plus, they paint Steve Wozniak in, like, it just the most sort of stereotypic way that you would consider Wozniak if you didn't know anything about him.
I saw the pictures of him. He looks kind of ridiculous.
It's Hurley from Lost playing Steve Wozniak.
That's why I look familiar.
But it's a fairly funny movie if your expectations aren't high.
Mm-hmm. I think. Gosh. There's well, even it sounds one. Like it's also like good geek.
It's total
geek lore.
Exactly. It's total. I mean, do not look to this movie at all for any sort of accuracy in the story. I think we're gonna have to wait for the David Fincher one. That's gonna.
Did you
see
the Ashton Kutcher one already came out?
The Ashton Kutcher one had a limited screening at I think it was at Sundance. Might have been a different film festival. One of the film festivals had a.
That's the one I want to see. That's where the comedy's gonna be.
Yeah, I mean, from what I understand about that one is extremely sort of saccharine and more of a hagiography than anything else.
Can you define what hagiography is?
It's basically a
thank you, Dwayne.
Painting Steve Jobs as a larger than life legendary figure with no real sort of negative, you know, chinks in his armor.
Oh, like Kim Jong Il.
Exactly. Like,
yes.
Exactly. So that would be the definition of a hagiography, essentially. But no, the one I'm really looking forward to is, of course, the Aaron Sorkin pen David Fincher one that's in the works.
Mm. Yeah.
But anyone who has a mild interest in Steve Jobs should watch this movie just for the sheer comic value of it. It's not an incredibly funny movie per se, but what's funny is the blind inaccuracies in it will make you laugh. And I think that was the intention. I'm fairly certain that was the intention. Like, one of the high points of this movie for me, it was Justin Long as Steve Jobs discovering the actor Justin Long for the Mac versus PC campaign and casting him in a, you know, like in a, finding him in a, watching an old screening of a movie called Jeepers Creepers, which apparently is a real movie that Justin Long was.
Oh yeah. That's a movie. Yeah. Jeepers Creepers. That's a classic.
Just so many inaccuracies and worth it. And we'll link to it in the show notes.
You know what I'm looking forward to? I'm looking forward to the House of Cards style tech business corporate drama that comes up in all this Steve Jobs era stuff. Because you know there's going to be a Sondra Rhimes type scandal type show or a House of Cards type show. It's all about technology and like espionage and like the drama surrounding it and founding stuff.
A scripted drama, right? Not like a reality
scripted.
Show.
Looking for like the scripted one. Like, I know the reality. That's great. I want
to
see.
I would love to see that too.
Super drama.
Yeah. That would be that should definitely be something on Netflix's radar to provide something like that. Okay, so let's go around the table here. I'll start with you, Chris. Where can we find your work on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down?
So you can find me every Monday and Friday at the Startup Digest. I co-curate
newsletter of awesome startup related events and articles for the week. And I really focus on the tech side of things more than the startup side of things. So even if you're not really into startups or just interested in tech, it's a good place for it. And then I tweet at CRISPRNOR on Twitter, CHRISBRNOR, and I blog at the same, CRISPRNOR.com. And pretty much any website, I've probably signed up under that name. I'm even on OLARC. Probably one of the very few people still on OLARC. Not that I ever go there, but I'm there. So, look me up.
Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can always find me on Twitter. I think even my Fitbit does Twitter now. so that's twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DWAYNED. You can also find information about me and what I do on Clip Interactive, clipinteractive.com. The blog is a work in progress. Starts with press releases and moves on to what the company's doing, and that's me or curated by me. And then finally, if you want to know everything I'm doing, just go to flavors.me/DwayneD. That's flavors.me/DWAYNED, and that kind of lays out everything I'm doing.
All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com or Twitter.com/MrBabyMan and Facebook.com/MrBabyMan. As for the drill down, you can find past episodes of the drill down as well as any of the other terrific shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on GeeksOfDoom.com. Subscribe to us by going to iTunes, and you can go to geeksofdoom.com, and our iTunes link is in the right-hand sidebar. Our show's on Stitcher, so you can listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, and other devices by going to stitcher.com and searching for The Drill Down. We're at facebook.com/TheDrillDown, twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.